then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 21st, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, at any given time, the party is dealing with individual migrants, people who are seriously preparing, or now that summer's here, actually making their migration home. We assist them in the various limited ways that we're able to offer assistance, so forth and so on. Over the past week, we've had several specific migration-related issues come up, including some questions about what we call PSAs, primary settlement areas, i.e. exactly where do we want new migrants to come home to. Now, I'll get into that in a little bit, but I think this week I'll let Andy kick it off since he's been dealing with this as well, and he also has some comments on the nuts and bolts of Northwest migration.
Greetings from Seattle. This is Andreas Donner. The party has been approached with questions about where someone should target when it's time for them to make a scouting trip and migration. This is another one of those subjects we need to cover repeatedly because new folks come in all the time. That, and there's a new wrinkle to this topic which I'm going to have to incorporate more aggressively than was previously appropriate, so I really do need to rehash this with everyone. Okay, so where to migrate? Well, obviously within the boundaries of the proposed homeland. But more specifically, the one thing the party needs more than any other is Northwest settlers on their own two feet, in every sense of the term. What that translates to practically is that each and every one of you out there needs to make sure that above all else, you're going to land someplace where you personally will be able to succeed economically. I emphasize this first and foremost because there's an understandable desire to move where someone perceives the action to be. Hey, I get it. You've got a specific purpose in migration, and you want to see that through. I can't fault anyone for thinking that way about their own move. Just the opposite, in fact, since they're thinking about the goal first and foremost, which I always respect. But the goal is long range. Yeah, okay, that's odd to hear me say, but I've got a feeling I'm going to say a number of things I never thought I'd say before this segment is over. And on that note, I've been trying to work up material on this action everyone is so concerned about. I'm sure I'll get around to it soon, but I need to make certain it's not outright depressing, since it requires bursting some bubbles about what actually goes on up here. Stay tuned for that in the near future. What I'm getting at is that your location choice needs to be primarily some place you personally can exist and thrive. The goal of Northwest migration isn't to set yourself up into a permanent state of barely making ends meet. That being the case, not only will you need to relocate to some place with economic opportunities, but you yourself need to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. This means that you're going to need to acquire some sort of marketable skill. Note I didn't say college. It's true that for many of our people, college is entirely out of reach for one reason or another, but college wasn't ever the gateway to limitless wealth and happiness it was billed to be. Our movement has a very bad habit of pretending a person's economic status is either that of the bourgeoisie or the pauper, and nothing in between. Most of the people who staff my regular coffee spots around Seattle actually have more impressive educations than I. Further, quite a few skilled tradespeople make much better money than some poor office drone utilizing his college education to the fullest of its potential. There have been times I've worked in such office situations for some skilled and talented people with little or no education past high school. Whatever else you do, don't let a lack of higher education deter you. As for actual migration prep, our standard line is that it ought to take a year. If you can do it faster, great, but make sure you know what you're getting into and research where you plan to move quite a while before even scouting the location out. The internet makes this a pretty simple task, since just about anything you want to know about any location in the United States is available as official record somewhere. But back to this idea of a year-long migration. There's a reason for it. Quite frankly, I can't believe I'm even contemplating what I'm about to say, but here it is. In certain cases, one should consider waiting the full year. I'm sure that sounds off, especially coming from me, but if most of you are coming from a situation where you've been barely existing, it could take a year of very strict budgeting and tight living to save up what you'll need. And on the note of budgeting what you need, this amount changes drastically based on where you're thinking of moving. Be sure to research that out entirely before taking the leap. This is the real reason behind the year-long migration prep phase. If you're in a bad situation economically, you're going to have to do what you can to get out of it. If, by some alignment of the stars, you find yourself suddenly well-employed, even if just relatively well-employed, out of the blue, you might just consider sticking that out. Not only will you be in a better situation a year later than you would be if you saved up just enough to survive for a bit in the homeland, but there's a good chance you're being exposed to a useful skill at the same time. You might actually try sticking it out for a bit longer than you otherwise would to make use of anything you might be able to claim as a new skill or specialized knowledge. A certain portion of the party's correspondence I've dealt with over the last year is from young men who haven't properly learned to be adults yet for one reason or another, and I understand this entirely. Our society, for reasons you'll all be very familiar with, has lost the ability to give freshly hatched adults a reasonable chance at starting their lives off the right way. Spending time working a job or learning a skill is only going to make your chances better when you do come home, especially if said job or skill is one of your first. Okay, I'm still in a state of disbelief after having heard myself make these remarks. While the party has never asked anyone to turn on a dime because it's entirely impractical to do so, we do recommend any delays be minimal. But then again, this advice applies to people who have already somewhat established themselves. There's an entire generation coming of age who has never had any chance to do so. This is further complicated by the reality that most of those under 30 years of age are still economically crippled. You young guys are really going to have a time of it, and if you end up getting the chance to work a real job before coming home, you ought to do it. I've spent enough time on that, and frankly, I'm a little bit cross for having had to give the advice I've given today. I'm going to have to console myself with the truth that different extremes are in play for much of the younger population. Just real quick, though, you guys who have your acts together and could actually migrate, you know, the Optimates Herald mentions from time to time, this whole Northwest imperative thing was tailor-made for you guys, and it's a continuing disappointment more of you don't accept the responsibility to your race you've been dealt. It's supposed to be you guys helping with the problems like this, but no, you're too good for it. Or whatever, we get it. But the point stands, unless you've got a marketable skill, you should probably spend as much time as possible prepping for migration. Unless you're totally sure of what you're doing, don't just cut and run once you get your first and last plus gas money and a little more to feed yourself. Do actual migration prep work for a year. And on the subject of prep, it's more than just economic. Merely fantasizing about migration doesn't count. It's one thing for new people to need guidance, but it's another thing for longtime RFN listeners to email with questions we've been over time and time again. Yes, the cities in the Pacific Northwest are significantly different from the rural areas. They're more expensive because they provide more opportunity. There are non-whites. There are also lefty-lib so-called progressive morons. Not nearly as many as you might think, but that's for another day. In addition to being familiar with the general situation in the homeland, you need to have read the Northwest Independence novels and consumed the party's introduction packet, especially the latest version of the White Book. That stuff is not optional, and we don't want someone to come home with misconceptions about what we're up to, since, were this to happen, it would be very bad news for everyone involved. I've gone on long enough as is, but I need to cover one last thing. You really do need a scouting trip. You're going to have to make your own decisions about where you land, since a person's living situation is nothing if not theirs to work out. We can't make your choices for you since we, quite literally, don't know you. Telling you where to move, live, and work isn't something anyone but you can do. We would all like to live in an area that is inexpensive, near opportunity, and free of non-whites. As yet, that doesn't exist, and that's all there is to it. Every choice is a trade-off, and only you can make these trade-offs for you. Because of this, we can't draw you a map and give you a set of directions more specific than these guidelines. Just so I'm clear, we'd love to change that, but for the time being, this is what you get. Hail victory.
Okay, I think this week is an appropriate time for me to deal with the question of primary settlement areas, or PSAs as we call them, since this week we've welcomed two new families of migrants, one here in the Pugetopolis and one in the southern part of Washington State. I don't want to give any more details at this time because these families are just settling in, and I don't want to run even the faintest risk of accidentally giving away something where these comrades could be identified by hostiles. But later on, when they get settled in, I hope they may come on and talk about their homecoming. Our guys up here in Puget Land are also working with another family who will be departing from the East Coast around the 1st of June and coming to the Puget Sound area, and we're hoping to help them get housed and employed here very quickly. I occasionally get emails from people to the effect of, come on, Harold, give us some nuts and bolts details, step by step. Hold our hands and walk us through this whole migration process. Tell us exactly where all these PLEs you claim to have are located. Well, we don't have any PLEs. That's Pioneer Little Europe, for those of you who aren't 100% on all your obscure movement terminology. Now, Pioneer Little Europe is actually a variation on what we here in the Northwest call Beaver Cleaverville. Or, for those of you who don't remember that show, I guess you'd call it Brady Bunch Burg. This is the idea that racially aware white people who are tired of all the crap should all move to some little town or rural county out in the boondocks and create a kind of 1950s theme park, complete with white picket fences and backyard barbecues and cheerleader girls in ponytails and bobby socks, and that out of the sheer goodness and benevolence of the dictatorship's heart, we would be allowed to do so and be left alone in our nice little all-white bubble while the rest of the country goes to hell around us, which is really where this idea falls down. Now, we seem to have difficulty losing this idea that there is some way that we can prevent extinction while remaining within the dictatorship's laws, and that somehow we will be allowed to opt out of this filthy system. Now, ask Randy Weaver and the Branch Davidians how successful they were in opting out. Nobody is ever allowed to yell, "Stop the merry-go-round, I want to get off." You see, the system won't work unless everybody is forced to play, but especially white people. Now, the ultimate attempt at a PLE is the Boer state of Orania in South Africa, where, of course, the South African Supreme Court, full of Kaffirs, recently ordered them to accept blacks. And the people of the covenant are, of course, bowing their heads and shuffling their feet and obeying their masters like good houseboys. We white people are obsessed with finding some way that we can play the game and win the prize without putting anything on the table. I think Bill White put it best. Let me see if I can remember exactly how he said it. There are many people out there who actually believe as we do and who sincerely want to see us win and sincerely want to see some kind of homeland for white people. But they will not undergo even the most basic kind of personal or psychological discomfort in order to achieve it. There is no way that we are going to win. There is no way that our people are going to survive. There is no way that we are going to create any kind of future for our race without everybody, and that includes you, going through at least some degree of personal, physical, and psychological discomfort. Now, so far as I know, no one has ever succeeded in creating any PLEs at all. I may be wrong about that, and if so, I'd be very interested in hearing about it. But in any case, we don't call them PLEs. We do have a few of what we call PSAs, primary settlement areas, which are parts of the homeland where we recommend people move to. They are not all white. They are not some sort of separate white la-la land where everybody runs around looking like a fugitive from a 1970s sitcom. They're just parts of the Northwest which have sufficient jobs and infrastructure to support an influx of new people and which are reasonably decent places to live. Now, right now, there is little in the way of organized NF activity in these areas for a variety of reasons. Now, we hope that will change over the coming months and years, but largely it's because the people who are coming here, being native-born white Americans and not brown new Democrats who just swaggered across the now completely open border and picked up their EBT cards, all these people that are coming here have to work for a living, which in these times and on our societal level generally means work at least 60 hours a week in order to make ends meet. Now, does anybody still remember the 40-hour work week these days? Does anybody still have one? Those of you who know your history will know that one of the reasons that the early labor unions fought for the 40-hour week was specifically so that working people, which in those days meant white people, would have time to participate in political activity. And, of course, that's one of the reasons that the big bosses, like the Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefellers, fought against the 40-hour work week, so that their economic serfs would not have time to meddle in politics and things that didn't concern them. We seem to have lost all that in the shuffle. Right now, if you're employed, you either have to work two 29.5 per week hour jobs so the employers can evade the Obamacare requirement, which works out to 59 hours, or else you have an approximately 60-hour a week job hourly with overtime if you're lucky. That's another thing that's starting to slide, the mandatory overtime. Like so much else, the Democratic Party and the wealthy capitalists of the Republican Party have discovered that no one's going to actually enforce these laws. But mostly, people work on a salary these days, which means that they can work you like a dog because you're doing the work of two or three employees who should be there but who can't be hired because of the combination of Obamacare and the Obama Depression. Now, that's pretty much the way it is everywhere throughout the empire. And yeah, a lot of that applies here in the Northwest as well. Although, from what I can observe, at least here in the Seattle area, it's not quite so devastating due to the concentration of really high-paying jobs. And there is such a thing as a trickle-down effect, where there's a lot of money floating around, it gets spread around. And there do seem to be a few pockets left of private sector jobs with 40-hour work weeks and benefits throughout the Northwest. Of course, once you get here, you can always register Democrat and get on with the state or federal government and the bureaucracy, although in Idaho you'd need to register Republican since Idaho's a red state. A lot of the bureaucracies do still have 40-hour per week jobs in cubicles and whatnot, and they have some benefits. I was told last week by one of the comrades in the Seattle area that he was seriously considering registering as a Democrat and letting it be known that he registered as a Democrat because he was angling for this one particular thing he needed. And the only way he might get it without a year or two of delay was to go along to get along, so to speak. And by the way, I consider that to be a perfectly legitimate and acceptable white survival technique. America today is, in some sense, like living in Mayor Daley's Chicago 50 years ago. No one does any good by rendering themselves unemployable out of principle. And I am really rambling off the topic here, aren't I? How am I on time? Okay, guys, I probably need to go to first music break now, and then we need to get a couple of contributors in. Okay, tell you what. We got Gretchen coming up. We got a comrade from Arizona who wants to have his piece. And after, say, second music break, I'll be back and I'll get a lot more into the nitty-gritty detail of these primary settlement areas. See you then.
Down in Flanders, tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from. fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilashandra. Oh, come out, you pretty Johns, come out. Come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilashandra. Oh, come out, you black and tans. Come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to discuss Arthur Kemp's AWB, Victory or Violence. Now, in this book, Kemp wishes to pay homage to Tyr Blanche, who he calls misguided and often wrong, but brave. Tyr Blanche was born in the Western Transvaal from a traditional Afrikaner family. His grandfather was a Cape rebel that had taken up arms in the Boer War. This book is going to focus on the relationship between the National Party, the HNP, which is a slightly more conservative branch of the National Party, and then also the Conservative Party and the AWB. Honestly, there were symptoms of breakdown within the apartheid system fairly early on, and took a while for Tyr Blanche to really want to break with the National Party. But by 1969, Tyr Blanche had joined the HNP and eventually started the AWB as a pressure group. Like the early National Socialists, at first there were only 7 men in the AWB, and it was started on July the 7th in 1973. In relatively short order, Tyr Blanche was expelled from the HNP because he had lied about his AWB membership. In 1977, he started to become active in various protests. In 1979, he became famous for being involved in the tarring and feathering of a professor who had spoken against the Day of the Vow, calling it offensive to South African non-whites. At this point, a lot of Afrikaners were very sympathetic to Tyr Blanche, and thousands of dollars were donated to cover his legal costs. In this book, for the most part, we tend to see a legal system which, when it was functioning, still understood the issue of white survival. In 1979, the AWB unveiled its various principles. It really talked about itself in terms of a Christian struggle, and it was a believer in meritocracy instead of parliament, really was against parties, and was very concerned about the spiritual and physical assault that was really taking place against the white Christian race, as they put it. By 1984, the AWB had established their logo of the three sevens, which meant victory against Satan. And by 1986, it started really in earnest to request an independent Afrikaner state. Now, at this point, we're dealing with State President Botha, and he gave no response. Granted, at this point, the AWB were already seen as renegades because in the 1980s, they had been found to have a heavy cache of weapons. Also, Blanche had become known for his tendency to disrupt political meetings or to start rival political gatherings. Also, Boers were increasingly concerned about increasing their birth rate and taking in immigrants that they could possibly assimilate. Now, when Blanche asked the Conservative Party for a parliament seat, this was very much against the AWB's anti-entryism, anti-party policy. He was discouraged by the Afrikaner press. He never manages to actually get this seat, but he does try to get Conservative Party and the HNP to work together, and increasingly he is angry with the Conservative Party for not working with the AWB and the HNP enough. At this point, there were certain elements in the AWB, such as Rudolph, who realized that peaceful petition would not work. The situation continues to deteriorate, and Nelson Mandela, of course, is freed on February 11th, 1990. There was the hope at this point that the Conservative Party would force a new election. But, of course, things just continue to deteriorate and go forward. The emblem of the AWB was similar to National Socialist emblems, but when you look at the philosophy of the AWB, it's very much Afrikaner and Bible-based, and really much more like Christian identity than it is National Socialism, so the resemblance is more superficial. Now, of course, we all remember, if we're old enough to remember it, the situation at the South African World Trade Center when dramatically the AWB busted into the center with an armored car, handed over a petition again for an Afrikaner state. At this point, Boers made a unilateral declaration of independence, but there was a split within their ranks. Tyr Blanche was always rather phobic of electoral politics and did not want to get involved in the multiracial election, whereas other elements in the AWB did. Fortunately for the AWB, they were granted amnesty, as amnesty was extended all the way to events that occurred before May 10th, 1994. Now, at this point, Tyr Blanche's activities catch up with him, and he does spend some time in prison. During this time, he becomes much more religious. In 2001, he demilitarizes the AWB, and in 2004, he makes the announcement that he's turning the AWB over to God. In 2008, he gets released. Now, he continues his appeals for an Afrikaner state, and in 2010, he was murdered on his farm by one of the blacks. Now, he has a very large funeral. Anywhere from 3,000 to 7,000 Afrikaners attended, and the AWB was given over to Von Range. This book really gave me so much information about the AWB and Keir Bland that's really almost more than I can fit into a podcast. But I hope you enjoyed this review, and I thank you very much for listening. And I'm always fascinated with the Afrikaners because really, in the fullness of time, it could happen to any of us what was happening to them. So good evening and hail victory, comrades.
And this is Comrade Drew from Arizona.
Greetings, comrades. There were a few segments in the April and May editions of RFN which caught my ear, so to speak, and I wanted to chime in on them, one of which concerns Brian from Illinois and how his beliefs, the people in his social and professional lives, don't quite gel. I'd first like to say that I know exactly what you mean and what you're dealing with. I've interacted with these people in school, in the workplace, and socially, and it can be as irritating as it is disheartening, but most of the time it's just irritating. And you're right, these people are children. They're children in how poorly their logic, if there is any, stacks up to critical thinking and facts. However, I've learned along the way that in many cases you simply have to swallow your pride and keep silent. I know that may not be the answer you wanted to get, but it's what has to be done. Getting us right-wingers, as we apparently are called, getting us going is kind of a live entertainment for them. They found one of the kooks, and they just want to see what we say next. It's fun for them. If there ever is a time where you think that someone might be open for discussion, I'd say just be very, very subtle. Just be cool. Be suave. If you just dive right in, try to give them the whole dose, they'll clam up, they'll shut down, and all progress will be lost. I found it kind of best to get somebody to say, oh, well, I found this. I thought it was worth a read. Here, what do you think? Just kind of give them information, let them read and think about it and mull it over and come back. I've actually got 3 or 4 friends by doing this, and they're slowly waking up. Slowly. I also recommend keeping a friendly personality and being pretty presentable. If you don't fit the image of a neo-Nazi skinhead wandering down the streets screaming gas the kikes, race war now, if you don't fit that bill, then already they're kind of caught off guard because you're not who they expected you to be. You're supposed to be Joe who lives down the block, who plays baseball with his kids and goes to the movies once in a while. You're not supposed to be like these other people. Huh, I wonder what could have made you think like this. I'm genuinely interested. Let me talk to you and we'll see what you know. This is how I see it anyways. Next, I wanted to touch briefly on the doomsday prophecies mentioned in the Dueling Codgers segment. Good name, by the way. I laughed. I've noticed through my readings that doomsday prophecies have been pretty common through the ages. The end is always just around the corner with the blacks pulling a Mau Mau on us, or Aslan being proclaimed and just general buffoonery befalling us. However, even I'm beginning to think that the big one, you know, the big cataclysm is around the bend, and I believe I know why. There's a book, which I highly recommend, called Fate of Empires by John Glove, which states that all empires die, or more accurately, commit suicide within 200 years, and that every empire has certain stages it goes through before this death. Now, one of Harold's sort of offhand comments got me to thinking. On multiple occasions, he's mentioned that Lincoln was America's first imperial president, which he was. Now, assuming that 1865 was when the U.S. officially became an empire, that would give us 200 years or until 2065 until the bottom falls out, and we get culturally enriched to the max. Now, besides just some dates and some numbers I've thrown, we can back up this idea that in 2065, or somewhere around in there, everything will just go to hell. Well, what else happens before then? One big thing I can think of is whites become the minority. And not only will we be a minority, but we will have such a high median age, we will have no hopes of replenishing our numbers. So, now that whites are a minority, that means that niggers, wogs, spicks, feminists, and faggots can vote as a bloc to end racism now and end oppression and effectively make U.S. South Africa 2 electric boogaloo. And as some people have put it, the defecation will have hit the revolving oscillating blades. Also, as someone else once said, without Europeans, there can be no Europe. Similarly, without Americans, there can be no America. That's just some food for thought. Finally, I'd like to remark on the problems some would have with the power the NAR government would wield. This is a valid concern, I believe, because after all this time of tyranny and cronyism, corporatism, and pretty much general buffoonery, big government just doesn't sound like the answer. It sounds like the very opposite of the answer. However, a platitude I'm reminded of is, the size of the government wouldn't matter so long as it was your government. And I have to agree with this. If the government worked for the nation's best interest, invested in its people, and there is no corruption, whether it was libertarian or anarchist or monarchist wouldn't matter very little. Another way of thinking this may be an oversimplification, but it's what helped me see what I believe to be the necessity behind the power the NAR would have. As mentioned by Harold and many others, actually, the NAR would be a young nation, a newborn nation, surrounded by evil and those who would wish do us harm. We would need strong leadership to see us through these times and a strong people to follow through with these decisions. Commander Rockwell's captain and crew analogy comes to mind. But more to the point, I don't believe we would be capable of conducting ourselves properly in this new nation. After so many years of living under Zog and the moral depravity which he has sowed into our lives, I don't believe, even if we had an all-white nation, we would be able to function properly, or at least to a degree that would ensure our survival. We need standards, and we need people to enforce these standards. As time goes on, as we become the Aryans we are meant to be, and create the Western society we are famous for, I sincerely believe that the reins will be lightened, and government will become less and less intrusive. However, until such a time, we will need strong guidance. We need to train, and we need to remember who we are. I see the power of the government as a means to an end, not the end itself. I appreciate you letting me talk your ears off, comrades. I wish you all the very best, and hail victory.
I'm in a kind of murdering mood again this week, so here's Ralph Stanley and Patty Loveless.
You're ready for Pretty Polly.
I'm ready.
Okay.
Oh, Polly, Pretty Polly, would you take me in kind? Would you take me in kind? You just sit beside me and tell me your mind.
Well, my mind is to marry and never to part. My mind is to marry and never to part. The first time I saw you, you wounded my heart.
Polly, Pretty Polly, come and go along with me. Polly, Pretty Polly, come and go along with me. Before we get married, some pleasure we'll see.
Well, he led her over mountains and valleys so deep. He led her over mountains and valleys so deep. Polly mistrusted and then began to
Polly, your guess is about right. Polly, Pretty Polly, your guess is about right. I dug on your grave the biggest part of last night.
Then he led her a little farther, and what did she spy? He led her a little farther, and what did she spy? New dug grave with spit lying by. She knelt down before him and pleading for her life. She knelt
real Polly, pretty Polly that never can be. Polly, pretty Polly that never can be. Your past reputation been trouble to me.
Opened up her bosom as white as any snow. Opened up her bosom as white as any snow and stabbed through the heart and blood it overflowed.
Then he went down to the jailhouse and what did he say? He went to the jailhouse and what did he say? Kill pretty Polly and trying to get her.
Way. Okay, as promised, I've returned, and I'll give you guys some of those specifics that you keep screaming for. That is, as specific as I can get within the bounds of common sense and simple discretion. I remind everyone that we have some very unpleasant neighbors who are listening over the back fence, so if you're looking for names, addresses, and telephone numbers, not today, guys. Now, the fact is that for all me and Andy ranting and raving about it, Northwest migration is a matter of common sense, and it's not that hard once you accept the necessity of undergoing a brief period of discomfort in your life. There are whole websites all over the internet put out by various chambers of commerce up here and companies that are hiring and other sources telling people how to go about doing an interstate move within the United States and giving all kinds of nice places to retire to or move to if you got kids, an increasing number of which are in the Pacific Northwest. In most of the larger areas, you can get complete relocation packs mailed to you by the local chamber of commerce or city government that gives you everything you need to know. Always, of course, on the assumption that you have in your pocket those green pieces of paper which these people worship as God. Long-distance moves like this are something that thousands of people do every month, except they mostly do it from a position of so-called respectability, which means for reasons of publicly admissible and acceptable employment by the government or a nice respectable neoliberal corporation, and of course, usually it's done with the presence of money, at least more money than we usually have when we arrive. There are actually all kinds of resources available for people who want to come home that are far better and more comprehensive than anything our tiny little parties ever come up with. I sent out a list of them a few weeks ago to the Northwest Revolution list, and I got virtually no response. I just don't ever complain that the party doesn't give you any help with homecoming. We do. It's just that we don't give you a guaranteed job and money and a house all ready to move into with no effort on your part. And we don't descend on your home in New Jersey or Milwaukee and whisk you away on a flying carpet to the Northwest like Aladdin. Niggers aren't the only ones in this society with a sense of entitlement. That's what a lot of you really want. You'd migrate if we could make it like Scotty beaming people up to the Enterprise so that you yourselves need not undergo any personal, physical, or psychological discomfort. Yeah, I know, I'm raving again. Right. The first and most obvious PSAs in the Northwest are the major metropolitan areas, Seattle, Portland, Spokane, and to a lesser extent Boise, and a few smaller and much nicer second-string locations like Bend, Pocatello, Corvallis, Medford, Bellingham, maybe the Tri-Cities area in eastern Washington, etc. Now, Spokane is a big city with some niggers and spicks, a lot of them by Northwest standards, which would just look like a light dusting of mud compared to where most of you are living now. Portland is a huge metropolitan area with many very white and very livable suburbs, and not just rich suburbs either. There is still a strong white working class in Portland. The Pugetopolis itself is just ginormous, extending up I-5 effectively from Olympia through Tacoma, on up through Seattle itself and the near suburbs like Bellevue and Ballard, and northward damn near to Bellingham, I understand, although I've never driven up 95 north much beyond Everett. Let me make this clear. Yes, Portland and Seattle, and to a much lesser extent Spokane, are run by liberal Democrat political machines reliant on non-white, hippy-dippy, third-world immigrant and sodomitic votes concentrated in those cities, which are not representative of the normal population as a whole. and that is not likely to change anytime soon because wherever these people take over, normal white people flee, abandoning not just their homes, but the polling booths as well. Now, for many of you homecoming migrants, it will be necessary for you to secure some kind of gainful employment immediately on your arrival, i.e. a job. And if you're like most racially aware white people, who have been screwed to the wall by Obama's America, you will need a job very quickly. Because even after a year of scrimping and saving, your funds will be limited once you've laid out all your rent and deposits. This is especially true if you are a young or youngish person who, like so many white boys, dicked off in school and then went on to get some useless community college degree in sociology or comparative religions or whatever, and who never bothered to learn to do anything with your hands that anyone is willing to pay you money to do. Let me be really, really blunt. If you need a burger flipping job, you need to come to a city. Just not Seattle right now. In smaller Northwest towns, the burgers are flipped by local people, and no, I don't mean Mexicans, I mean local white people who are often doing it for a real living because sometimes it's all they can get. But on the subject of burger flipping and pushing broom, recently Seattle introduced a mandatory $15 per hour minimum wage for the city, which I think is already causing something of a migration here by unskilled people of all races who think they're going to be paid $15 an hour to work in Mickey D's. I just checked this on the net, and what is actually happening is that all the trendy, yuppie, and hipster restaurants downtown and in Queen Anne and up on Capitol Hill, like Little Uncle and Boat Street Cafe and this five-star Indian place I can't pronounce, anyway, they're closing down, right, left, and center. Because in the current economy, flipping burgers and bussing tables simply isn't worth $15 an hour. Now, the McDonald's and the Pier 51 ferry terminal has already closed down. That doesn't mean that you can't get a burger flipping job here in Puget. It just means that you probably can't get one in Seattle itself. And you need to try one of the outlying suburbs or come over here across the water. I see now hiring signs in store windows in Port Orchard and Bremerton and Silverdale all the time. Now, it is for this reason that many of you will most likely have to come home to one of the cities because the Northwest cities are where the jobs are. Common sense, people. And it's not just me who's saying this. The fact is that one problem we're running into here in the Pugetopolis has to do with what we call organic migration. The fact is that the Seattle area is one of the few areas in the empire where there are still good-paying jobs of any kind available in any quantity. And if you decide to come here, you will be part of a flood of thousands of people every month who are coming here in search of work, mostly for economic reasons, but some for racial motives as well, although, of course, they'll never admit to it. Occasionally, there are other reasons. We have one family who ended up in Portland because there was an educational and training thing available there that's available nowhere else. Now, all of that having been said, wherever there are more jobs, there are more people. And many of them will have faces the color of shit, because wherever white people are making money, the blacks and the browns follow so that they can get on the white man's back and ride. Housing costs are higher in the cities. This is still a more or less free market economy where supply and demand operates. In Seattle itself, housing costs are pretty high because there is an influx of high-techy skilled workers who are getting six figures a year. They need housing, convenient to work, and they can pay the big bucks. So the big bucks are charged. As much as we like having new comrades move in here to our own area of the Northwest so that we can meet you, I will go so far as to say this. If you are A, married and have a family, and if you B, are manually skilled, by which I mean if you can do something with your hands like plumbing, carpentry, electrical wiring, computer, hardware repair, if you're a skilled auto mechanic, whatever. If you have even a basic qualification in anything in the medical field that will help provide care for the aging white baby boom population, then you might want to consider one of the second string primary settlement areas where everybody needs you, the party and the community both. Bend, Corvallis, and Medford in Oregon would be good starting points to take a look at. With those skills, you'll be hired in a matter of days, I guarantee you. Eugene, I hear, is a nice place to live, but it's a liberal latte town full of students, and so housing is high. It's the home of the University of Oregon, and therefore the home of screaming lefty Marxists. I can live around them. I grew up in Chapel Hill. I find them amusing, and I like their lattes, but I know a lot of people can't handle them. Again, if you are sufficiently skilled in something that everybody needs so that you can support yourself, you might want to look seriously at Kalispell and Helena, Montana. We've got some good folks out there who could use the company. I suppose when one says Northwest Migration, one automatically thinks of Northern Idaho, and there are still some remnants out there from Pastor Butler's time. If you're Christian Identity, you might want to look at Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint. I understand that there are some CI communities out there still left over from the old days. Now, I would really, really like to get some good people into Boise. I was out there a few years ago, and I was impressed. Various reviewers have said on the net that Boise is about like Bakersfield, California used to be back in the good times 40 or 50 years ago, but not so murderously hot in summer and a lot colder in the winter. And by the way, for all my negativity about the city of Seattle itself, if you are skilled and if you can save up and acquire enough money for your rent and utility deposits, I would say by all means come here. I say again for the umpteenth time, do not judge the suburbs and the surrounding countryside of Seattle and Portland by those showers of shit in the Democrat-ruled city itself. There are still extremely nice places to live right on the Seattle city bus lines, and while Portland is a little rougher cut for various reasons, I'm told that it's the same down there.
Westward from the Davis Strait, 'twas there 'twas said to lie, the sea route to the Orient, for which so many died. Seeking gold and glory, leaving weather broken bones, and a long forgotten lonely care. For just one time I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing but one line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage toward the sea. 3 centuries thereafter, I take passage overland in the footsteps of brave Kelso, where his sea of flowers began. Watching cities rise before me, then behind me sink again. This tardiest explorer driving hard across the plain. For just one time I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one more line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage. And through the night, behind the wheel, the mileage clicking west, I think upon Mackenzie, David Thompson, and the rest, who cracked the mountain ramparts and did show a path for me to race the roaring Fraser. For just one time I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one more
I left a settled life. I threw it all away to seek a northwest passage at the call of many men, to find their hut, the road back home.
That 1 hour time limit has just slapped me in the face. So you guys make sure you pester me by email and I'll get back on this next week. But before I go this week, I'm going to go off script a bit. Virtually every week, somebody contacts me by email giving me a link to a website or a cut and paste from something they found on a website to the effect of, "Harold, Harold, look at what they're saying about you now. Look at this person, he's saying this horrible, wicked, evil thing about you on the internet. So, well, what do you think about that, Harold? Can I get a response on that, Harold? What do you say?" Mostly, this is just the natural human love of spreading gossip and being the first to bring bad tidings. Virtually all of this crap I have seen before. I haven't seen anything at all new along the goat dancing line for, oh, God knows how many years now. I'm not going to comment on that particular item, except to point out that it was over 15 years old. We have some people among us, or at least hanging around on the internet in our vicinity, and to these people, it will always be the year 1998, and the world will be centered around... Never mind. Anyway, I have long ago given up any hope that we are ever going to stop this. It seems to be an integral part of who we are and what we are. I don't know why we can't seem to stop. I don't know why we can't grow up. I don't know why we have to behave in this neurotic, adolescent, dysfunctional way, but whatever the reason is, it does seem to be kind of hardwired into us over the past couple of generations. And I have to say that although the internet has made it a lot worse, I remember before the internet, and in our own way, my generation was just as bad as this upcoming movement generation of kids who know nothing but the computer. So it's not as if there isn't enough blame to go around. What I want to ask guys is, when you see this stuff on the internet, and I'm serious now, don't bother to send it to me. I really am not interested. I've seen it all before. These people have nothing to say. They had nothing to say then. They have nothing to say now. It's stupid. It's childish. It is a waste of time. And I'm just really, honest to God, I am not going to mess with it anymore, guys. Enough. Anyway, for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and so bitter was their fate. Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow filled the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart and manhood's fight.